Hello and welcome to Biting Talk with Two Chicks, Britain's liveliest food and drink podcast, coming to you with effortless eggs, sparkling chat with talent from the culinary world, easily digested with, who knows, a cholesterol-free omelette perhaps. I'm William Sitwell, restaurant critic for The Telegraph, and this week's show is the last in the current season, and we close with a cracking lineup and no yolk. We'll be talking to a man who grew up in a family renowned across the world for their gastronomic endeavour. It's been an emotional year for Michel Roux Jr., manoeuvring his restaurant and catering business through the months of pandemic and having to deal both with the death of his uncle Michel and then his father Albert. I'll be chatting with Michel about how he's coped without the ever-present advice of his late father and hearing about his latest venture, Le Gavroche Gin. Also on this week's show, we'll delve into another spirit, a rum, created in the Scottish lowlands and inspired by an 18th century naval hero, John Paul Jones. Plus, we'll meet a woman who I first saw on Dragon's Den. Did you see the episode where two food entrepreneurs pitched their private chef business, Why Hangry, in the Den? Well, they got their investment, but how is business now they've been trading for a year? And was this the perfect wheeze, in fact, for lockdown-hungry Brits? But first, we meet Finian Gill, purveyor of rum and, is this right, a man who steeps his booze in Scottish seaweed? Well, there's been a gin craze for, I would say, a few decades now, but there's another one, another spirit craze coming our way. You may have sensed it, I've certainly sensed it. Bottles of new rums have been cascading through my door. The latest to attack me, Lowland Rum, John Paul Jones. Now I'm interested to find out about rum, how it's made, and this new delicious sounding rum. I've got a bottle. I'm far too scared to open it quite yet. But it's a rum created by three guys, Ollie Blackett, Jack Cudigan, and the head of product, Finian Gill, who joins me now on Biting Talk. Hi, Finian.
Hi, William. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. So I know that you studied booze, if I can put it like that. You went to the WSET, where lots of people start or certainly try and bolster their knowledge about wines and spirits. So you've got a good education. And here you are with your first product, 40% Alk Lowland Rum, which surprised me. I thought it all came from the Caribbean. First of all, before we talk about your specific one, just define what a rum is for us, will you?
So to be a rum, what you have to do is you have to distill the original spirit from a sugar cane. So in the same way that a whiskey is distilled from malted barley, the original distiller, the original product that you create that alcohol from via distillation is sugar cane.
Okay, that's nice and pure and simple. And does that sugar cane have to grow in the Caribbean, or can you try and grow it in other parts of the world? Or does it have to sort of have that original Caribbean location?
So as long as this is sugarcane, in theory, as long as you can grow sugarcane, which is, you know, is difficult by the way you have to grow it, as long as you can physically create it, then you can make rum out of it. The only one exception to that is rum agricole, which is made with sugarcane juice rather than the molasses. But yeah, you can make it anywhere.
Yeah, so that's a sort of cheats rum, rather like the big cider producers who use sort of rehydrated sugar syrups from Asia and China, and then they sort of turn it into cider. They call it cider. It's another thing altogether. Yours is a lowland rum. Just explain that to us. So your sugar cane, first of all, is from where?
So what we do is we import actually a Caribbean white rum. However, then what we do is we age it and we flavour it using hand-picked Scottish seaweed in and around Scotland. So that is what ties us to the lowlands of Scotland and ties us to the story of John Paul Jones, the namesake of our brand.
So it's a flavoured rum. Now, I know that when it comes to, you know, other spirits, you know, you have compound. There's various sort of different ways of getting the flavour in. Is there a kind of hierarchy of acceptable ways of flavouring? Where are you with the lowland one in terms of the way that you do it, steeping it, as you say, in seaweed?
So we set out, and sort of it's very much my mission to bring the spiced and flavoured rum category up to standards of the aged rums and almost the whiskies of the world. That I think it's always been a bit pirated that category by sort of people throwing lashings of vanilla, filling it with sugar and filling it with artificial flavors and processes that create products that everyone wants to drown in Coca-Cola. And we really set out to create something that, you know, if you want to drown it in Coca-Cola, you're more than welcome to. But on its own, it stands alone as something that is delicious and is tasty. So it will improve everything else that you drink with it. So we only use food grade seaweed that we handpick, as I said, and dry ourselves. And on top of that, we use root ginger, which is at a food grade again. So, you know, it's the things that exactly you'd cook with, unlike other people who use ground ginger or ginger extract. And on top of that, we use peppercorns, exactly the same quality you find in your kitchen. So we set out to create a really clean flavor profile using very, very fresh and, as I said, ingredients that you'd want in your food as well.
So you get your rum, and I want to ask you a bit more about that in a second, but it goes in a big steel container. How does that work?
So basically it's a massive vat. After the aging process, we take them out of the wood, and then we put it into massive vats. Then you have this sort of aged, delicious already rum. And what we do is we will literally sort of dip in almost like a mechanical tea bag. We will dip in this extract, this sort of pod of flavor, and that will sit in the rum for 24 hours, and it will just let those sort of lovely flavors infuse and marry and create this little twang of difference in the flavor profile. And then, yeah, we pull it out and bottle it.
And how does it work, the sort of purchasing of the rum originally? You go to the Caribbean, you rock up at a distillery and you buy huge vats and import it. How does that work?
So, well, we were born out of lockdown. So no matter how much we would have loved to sort of don our Panama hats and go down and check out the distilleries and stuff, sadly, our first batch we had to do via sort of sending of samples and things like that. But yeah, so it is all imported in PVC units. So that is imported in a sort of, if you can imagine, a very, very large jerry can, it is imported in that. And then we take it out of that and put it into our wood to allow it to mature in the UK. And then, as I said, then go into the steeping process.
Is that a sort of pure water-looking liquid? It's not coloured when you buy it.
Exactly. So what we import is a one-year tropically aged white rum, but it is white. So it will look like a vodka, and all of the colour that has already been imparted to it is actually filtered out. So we import, as I say, a white rum.
Right. Let's talk a bit about John Paul Jones, who's the inspiration behind the name. Your partner in the business was, I gather, brought up on the estate where he was born. Who was John Paul Jones? I know that he had something to do with the sea. And how does he lend his name to this drink?
So John Paul Jones, not to be confused with the guitarist or the bassist for Led Zeppelin, who coincidentally named himself after this John Paul Jones. He was born in the 1700s, and he was born the son of a gardener on a small estate, but sort of was very, very relatively sort of beautiful one in Dumfriesshire in the Scottish Lowlands. When he is born, sort of, as I said, the gardener's son, he's born not into anything, but he is born with a sort of sense of unstoppable adventure and this quest for sort of to go and to go on into the world and make it his own almost. So he starts off his life transporting rum for the Merchant Navy from, believe it or not, the UK to the Caribbean, where we collect our rum. So it's the inspiration for that beginning of our process. He then sort of has enough of transporting the English Navy, has a couple of run-ins with sort of the English system, which at that point was very, very rigid and didn't sort of allow him the opportunity to be that free-flowing man he wanted to be. So he traveled to America to seek out a new world. When he goes to America, America at this stage is very much in the fledgling of its sort of life. And he tries to sort of turn this sort of, I would describe it as sort of a flotilla of small boats into a navy. And he actually is successfully credited with co-founding the American Navy himself. He was one of the first people to raise the modern American flag. And he established himself basically throughout the American Revolution as a daring commander and a noble leader.
All right. Okay. So a buccaneering spirit and a certain amount of balls he had, which is something that you are going to have in order to be able to sell this stuff, because it's all very well creating a brand. Getting it into supermarkets costs an absolute fortune. What's your route to that market? How are you going to do it without, you know, dropping millions of pounds, which can very easily get absorbed into your marketing spend and so on. How are you actually selling this stuff and where can we get it?
Honestly, so the way that we're, just first answer is the way we plan on doing it. We plan on doing it by building up credibility as a brand, not created by throwing loads of money at it, because we only have our sort of our seedling amount of cash at the start. So we're looking to really build it up via consumers really pushing us by loving it. And we're starting to see that already. We've had people like Jonathan Ray, the head spirits writer of The Spectator, has come out and called it a belter and said it was one of his top tipples for Father's Day. Even Jeremy Clarkson tweeted about it and actually sent our website into meltdown the other day. And we were nominated for, we had a great response at Taste of London. And as of yesterday, we're nominated for the Great British Food Awards in two categories. So we're starting to see people really starting to push it and create that buzz around the product. We're trying to lead that via the flavor profile that we've created and sort of the honesty and transparency of the process we have. But yeah, the dream is to be everywhere.
And you want to be everywhere. Where are you at the moment?
Where are we at the moment? So currently most of our sales come direct to consumer. So we sell via our website, which is www.johnpauljones.uk. However, we are also turning up at pubs in the park over September and also a few other sort of events we've got planned for Christmas. We're probably going to have a stand at Spirit of Christmas as well. So we are we're really starting to get out there and be in front of people. But in the meantime, the website is the best place to go.
Great. Well, you are going to talk about this stuff till you're blue in the face. So good luck with that. Good luck with the spiel as you go on. And perhaps we'll see other little products as you build your brand. But it's been a great pleasure. And if anyone wants to try this Lowland rum, johnpauljones.uk is the website. Finian Gill, thanks for being on Biting Talk.
Thank you very much.
I first came across my next guest watching an episode of Dragon's Den a few months ago, and we can dwell on how they did on that show. But the key thing is that this business is now a year old. It's the brainchild of two women born respectively in China and India, Hainan Zhang and Sidi Mittal. It's an amazing idea, private chefs in your own home. But to tell us all about the business, I'm delighted to say that I'm joined on Biting Talk by Hainan Zhang. Welcome to Biting Talk, Hainan.
Hi, Will. Lovely to be here. Thank you so much for the introduction.
That's fine. Now, listen, just tell us, because I'm struggling. You're hungry? Why hungry? We're hungry. How do you say the name of your company?
I think you've just named a few of the options we've heard. So it's Why Hangry, but we do get variations of it. So anything goes, but we prefer Why Hangry.
Why Hangry it is. You are the co-founder of Why Hangry. Let me wish you a happy birthday. You've done a year of trading now. Your stats that I've looked at are pretty impressive. You've had 10,000 happy diners, 2,000 dinner parties, you've got 300 chefs in London. Let's just go back to that moment when I first saw you on Dragon's Den. Remind us how you got on and what the worst and best feedback was you got from that panel of judges.
Oh my God. I mean, it seems like eternity ago, because I think we went to pitch in Manchester in November 2020. And I think we were in the den for maybe 2.5 hours, and everything now seems a bit like a blur, but there were some really, really tough moments. I think when Peter was asking us about valuation, then we got questions around like chefs, and then we got questions about logistics from Deborah, who's obviously had a lot of experience in the industry. So I don't know which one in particular. Tuker was also very tough. So I mean, lots of difficult moments.
And what did you leave the den with?
So we left the den with a deal with Tej and Peter.
And how is that going? Because I'm intrigued, because I am a fan of that show. Are they hands-on in your business? Have they made a big difference? I don't see their names smattered across your press releases.
So we are still in the due diligence process. So a lot of time and effort is spent on obviously like making sure everything is agreed in a den, but then obviously done due diligence on.
Okay, fine. So they're not actually on board yet, which is interesting. So the original concept, the concept that you pitched famously in the den, was the idea of private chefs coming to your house, hosting a dinner at home, and providing what you describe as the sophistication and ease that comes with eating out. Now, I wonder whether the pandemic has been good for you in some ways, because, of course, it has highlighted the home as a space to eat in. But then I suppose also tough because you probably couldn't have any events. Tell me about that.
I mean, I think the past 18 months have been such a roller coaster. When it comes to the pandemic, like definitely, as you say, there are like the two different directions. Like on the one hand, we weren't allowed to operate during the first lockdown at all. And then we were allowed to operate only for more limited events, given household rules around how many people are allowed to gather. So there have been these two opposing factors. But when it comes to actually the overall trends, I think the rise of in-home dining has really been proven by the rise of delivery services and the success of Deliveroo, let's say, meal kits and Gorilla, Wheezy, and all of the convenient last mile delivery services. They show that people want to spend more time at home. And then we also see that over the past decade, even before COVID, there were stats around the rise of hometainment. I think half of pubs and nightclubs in the UK had closed over the past decade before COVID. And that was with millennials liking to host at home, but the way they host was different. A lot of people don't know how to cook. So a lot of times hosting would be potluck or just wine and cheese or just drinks rather than a full-on dinner party, which used to be the case. But it doesn't mean that people don't like actually having food at home when they socialize. So for us, we really see like the future of home being the new gym, the new office, as well as potentially the new place for socializing with Waihengri, who makes makes entertaining much easier.
Yes, okay. It's interesting you say that, but I know that there are restaurateurs who obviously have had a very tough year, who've actually had some of the best months in, you know, on record for their own businesses. People are aching to get back out. We all know how difficult it is if we're booking restaurants to actually get tables, partly, I suppose, because there's a staff shortage, but restaurants are full. Have you managed to persuade people that actually they should stay at home and have dinner with one of your private chefs and not go to a restaurant? Because that must be a concern for you.
So we're not anti-restaurant at all. I think I love going out to restaurants, and there's so many different places in London that are amazing, and I can't even name them all, and we're not here to replace restaurants. I think when it comes to what we're trying to offer, most of us want to spend more time with people we care about, and a lot of us actually like having people over in addition to meeting up with friends in restaurants, because it's a slightly different value proposition. You don't have to leave the table after 2 hours. You can control the music. You can have those deep, meaningful conversations until early in the morning if you wanted to. So I guess eating out in restaurants has become the default way of sharing a meal, but often the most memorable times don't necessarily happen there. I go out to restaurants because I'm crave something at X restaurant. But then when I just want to get different people together who might not know each other and who I think would be bring electricity to the room and would be super, super fun to have them all together, I wouldn't say, hey guys, let's book a table for 10 at this place, which is also very difficult and you have to leave, but rather, hey guys, come over to mine. So it's a bit different, and we're creating a alternative rather than trying to replace restaurants, if that makes sense.
Take me through the process then. If I want to have a Waihengri dinner at home, you've got 300 chefs in London. How does the process work? How do I get the dinner that I want? And what does it cost?
So if you wanted to book a dinner, you would visit waihengri.com and you would either browse through the set menus that we offer, or you can go and curate your own menu from the different cuisines and dishes that we offer. So some of our most popular cuisines are Pan-Asian, European, and Mexican. And then you can select the starters, mains, sides, and desserts from within those cuisines according to your preference. And in terms of cost, so our minimum spend is £100. £100 includes everything, chef and groceries, and our cheapest menu would start from £17 per person.
Okay, so £100, that's the minimum charge. That seems incredibly good value. I mean, what are you paying your chefs?
So chefs get paid differently according to the length of the booking. So on our small bookings, our margins are super thin. For us, it's about creating a new category and making chefs more accessible. When it comes to our customers, 70% of our customers had never booked a private chef before. I think the analogy here is looking at the the Uber customer who wasn't using black cabs before Uber existed and made it more affordable. So when it comes to our customers, they are booking for various different events, and depending on what they choose in terms of food, we will arrange the logistics. So we will take care of the groceries, where we partner with online grocers so that everything gets delivered to the customer's home. And then we will arrange the best chef who will cook everything fresh from scratch at the customer's home. But the chef doesn't need to do the admin. So we as a platform will take on the communication between the customer and the chef that normally would need to happen and would take a lot of time for the chef and the customer.
And I suppose one of the big questions is, what pots and pans have you got in your own home? Because they may not suit the chef. Does the chef bring his own cooking equipment, or does he rely on your customer's batteried cuisine that they have?
Yeah, so the chef relies on what the customer has at home. Based on the dishes that the customer chooses, our tech platform will create a dynamic checklist. If you were to choose, let's say, a coriander chutney, then your dynamic kitchen checklist would have a food processor. Whereas if you don't choose that dish, that's not part of the kitchen checklist. So when the menu and the dishes are selected, the customer will see a dynamic checklist of utensils and pots and pans, food processor, whisk, and so on, whatever is required based on exactly what's chosen. So in case the customer doesn't have certain things, we can then liaise with the customer and recommend items or ask our chefs to pick them up as a one-off.
Okay, and you're in London at the moment. Are your ambitions beyond the capital, other cities across the UK and then overseas? Are there people doing this in other countries? Are there territories you try to get into with this, with your platform?
So at the moment, we're only in London. We only recently expanded into Greater London from initially Central London, purely Central London. Our ambitions are definitely global. I think anywhere in the world, people are getting together in order to spend time and create memories with their friends. And that means that our market isn't restricted to whether it's London or the UK or any other country. And our aim is to be a global business in a few years' time. But for now, we really need to focus on London and make sure that we offer a 7-star service to our customers in London, which includes having the best chefs, the best logistics, and all in all, like a seamless customer experience.
Great. Well, I would like one of these people for breakfast, lunch, tea, and dinner, if you could arrange that.
We
and,
can make that happen.
Send someone along. Send someone along as well who can do all the washing up, and that'll make me happy. You can look for Why Hangry if you'd like to book a chef if you happen to be in London. But meanwhile, it's been wonderful having you on. Thank you, Heinen, and best of luck. We'll touch base in 5 years and 10 years and see how your plans to take over the world are going on. But really exciting to chat with you. Thanks so much for your time. Heinen Zhang.
Thank you.
Now, there's been a gin craze that won't have passed your mind over the last 10, 15, 20 years, but I'm delighted to say that one of our top chefs, one of the great legends in the culinary world in this country, if not globally, has joined the party of making gin. His name is Michel Roux Jr., and he's on Biting Talk this week. A very warm welcome to you, Michel.
Thank you. And it's a shame that we're doing this over the phone, because if we were face to face, I would have poured you a little gin.
Oh, exactly. And there's, you know, the time is always right for a little tipple, especially if mixed by you. Before we go on to chat about that, just tell me, first of all, whereabouts are you talking to me from? I'm in Somerset. Where are you?
I am in sunny South London, in Clapham to be precise. And I've lived in South London for, well, nearly all of my life, actually. So, and it's I'm telling a lie because it's not really sunny at all.
Now, you're famed for your marathon running. Have you had a run today? Have you been out jogging? Or and will, if not, will you?
probably this afternoon, before gin o'clock.
If a day goes by where you haven't stretched those limbs and got your heart rate going, apart from the stresses of the kitchen, does it frustrate you? Are you a bit of a, you know, is that a very key part of your daily schedule?
Yes, it is. Actually, it's an integral part of my daily life. Sport, or I mean, not, doesn't have to be necessarily intensive sport. I mean, you know, running marathons is pretty intense. But I'm a firm believer that, you know, 20 to 30 minutes of sport, getting the heart rate going, working up a sweat on your own without the phone or anything, is a great, great stress reliever. So not just for physical health, but most importantly, mental health.
And not always easy to find the time for it, because I know that, you know, kitchens are busy places. I know that in a kitchen such as yours, those afternoons between service, you often find young chefs experimenting, trying new dishes. So if trying to find a time when you're working from, let's say, 8 till 8 or beyond that for that jog, you've got to be quite disciplined, I suppose.
Yeah, I think, time management is vital, is important. But if you can find the time and you force yourself to find the time, the benefits are huge. And, you know, I mean, hospitality need to look at the hours that we work, and we need to cut back the hours. So if we can cut back the hours, then it means everybody can enjoy a little bit more time and maybe go on that run, or, you know, keep fit and then be a little bit more productive and better at work.
Now, the last time I saw you was actually at Wimbledon. You were catering for a huge mob outside in what I suppose is a huge car park, a very beautifully decorated tent. The thing that I suppose most struck me was the glad handing you were doing of people wearing a mask. Has your mask been shed, or are you still wearing it at Gavroche?
Yeah, so we're still wearing masks at events and at Le Gavroche, front of house especially. I think it's a reassurance for our guests, but actually it's also for our staff as well, for their safety too. So, you know, for the time being, we're still wearing them.
But it's so hard, isn't it, for customers to sort of see your face. Do you take it off for a selfie, or do you keep it on?
Actually, I don't. At Le Gavroche, guests will ask, oh, can you take your mask off for a photo? I say, well, actually, no, because, you know, I keep it on for respect for my team, my staff, because I'm asking them to keep the mask on. So the boss keeps the mask on at all times as well.
It's been a huge year in hospitality. It's been an emotional year for you, of course, because you lost your father, Albert, you lost your uncle, Michel, all in the space of sort of 12 months. How does it feel now that, you know, you've got your cousin Alain there at the waterside, there you are at Gavroche? Is there a big emptiness in your life? Do you feel the firm, occasionally witty hand of your father on your shoulder? How does the loss feel now, particularly when you're in the kitchen? Do you sense Albert's presence? How does it feel now?
Yes, most definitely. I mean, I still think, you know, a lot about Dad and Uncle, and there are times where I get up, or sometimes even, you know, without even thinking about it, in the afternoon or whatever, and I go, oh, I must go and pop in and see Dad. And then I think, well, no, can't go, blood, can't, sorry. And I think, no, I can't go and see him. He's gone. And, you know, he'll always be here. He'll always be there and always be in our thoughts. And at the restaurant at Le Gavroche, you know, there's a big portrait of him, and we see him every day, and there's little photos of him when he was a young chef. And so, you know, he's always with us. And I still think about Dad when I'm creating menus, or when we're doing something important at the restaurant, and we'll, you know, he's there for inspiration and also for guidance, because I think, well, what would he say? What would he think? You know, and so, you know, he's always there in spirit.
Are there things that you do to the menu that you feel he'd be trying to nudge you to stop you doing? what's the sort of What's the advice that you don't miss?
Well, over the years, you know, I used to take it all on board and digest it, and his advice, that is, and then some of it I would take on, and some of it I would just immediately press the delete button. But for example, you know, when creating the menu at Le Gavroche, there will always be a nice, rich, indulgent dish. You know, it's something that's really, truly dad, you know, lots of butter, lots of cream, and unapologetically, you know, sort of really rich. And you know what? It's really nice to indulge in these dishes every now and then. And there is a demand. People want to come and you know, taste all that and eat all those calories. So, yeah, not all the dishes are like that, though. And some of them more like the new generation, my way of cooking, which is obviously a lighter touch. But there's, you know, I think it's important that we still have those dishes.
Yes. And just quickly, tell me how the staff shortage is affecting you, because I know that you stopped some services. When are you actually open at the moment, and you know, how are you dealing with that issue?
Yeah, there is a severe staff shortage. It's not just in hospitality, though. It's across the board. After reopening, we were working crazy hours. We were working like 90 hours a week, and it doesn't matter how much you pay people. You know, you just burn out at that. You know, you can't carry on. It's not sustainable. So I decided to shut for lunch, all lunches. So we're open now for dinner only Tuesday to Saturday, which means everybody's working reasonable hours, getting a good lie-in in the morning. Staff morale has improved immensely, and you know, everybody comes in with a spring in their step. We've increased the hours of opening a little bit to compensate for loss of trade. So we're now open. The bar is open at 4:30 and the first food order at 5 in the afternoon. And it's been incredibly popular. So, you know, in that respect, it's working. But it is tight. Financially, it's tight because I'm losing revenue of 70 lunch covers a day. So, yeah.
Gosh, and the customer is losing one of the best value lunches in London, and that's a shame.
Absolutely. Well, you know, we are hoping that we will be back up to full, you know, full speed and lunch and dinner by Christmas. So, you know, yeah.
But it's extraordinary because if you think, gosh, if there's one kitchen that surely would attract the attention of budding staff, it would be Gavroche. And if Gavroche even can't, you know, there, you know, you run famous culinary awards and prizes. You know, if the pinnacle of culinary achievement can't attract the talent, there really is a deep-seated issue, isn't there?
Absolutely. I think, I mean, you could say that Le Gavroche and Waterside Inn, when it comes to staff, are the litmus test. You know, if we're short-staffed, then everybody else must be really suffering too. But it is incredible. And as I said, you know, it's not just hospitality. It is across the board. And we're all fighting for the same, you know, the same small amount of willing hands that are about. And, you know, it's difficult. But I'm ever the optimist. It will sort itself out. It will take time, though. It will take time.
And if there's stress, well, you've got a new way of dealing with this. Le Gavroche Gin, taking its name, of course, from your restaurant. You've teamed up with a Staffordshire-based distiller. Now, listen, Michelle, gin, you're a bit late to the party, aren't you?
Never too late, especially when it comes to quality, because it is an exceptionally good gin. I was blown away by Nelson's, the company that make this gin, for their one of their speciality gins is flavored with Timur pepper. And I thought, my word, if they can distill a gin and have that amount of flavour, you know, I've got to, you know, hook up with them. So I did, and I found out that the distiller and owner is actually a chef, and he's worked in some fantastic places. So, you know, it kind of ties in really well. So I said I wanted a gin with some lovely flavours of Provence. So we've played around with lots of different botanicals, but especially thyme, rosemary, bay leaf, bitter orange. So, you know, I can paint the picture there. You can just, you know, see it. But most importantly for me, this is not a flavoured gin. It's a real gin. So, you know, the first thing you smell is obviously juniper berry, because that's important. If I want a gin and tonic, I want to taste the gin. And then come in these lovely, lovely sort of Provence flavours. And it's a really good gin, I must say.
And the process of making it is quite, well, in terms of sipping, is quite hard because you have to sip the raw alcohol, without tonic, without water. Did you have a bit of help with that? Because, of course, the uninitiated testing, trying gins when you've got a full blast of something like, 40%, it's quite difficult. How did you get your palate to understand the intensity of that alcohol, but also to be able to disseminate those flavours, Provençal, juniper and so on?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's not easy because if you do sip it straight from the distillery, then when it's, 40 plus degrees, it's burn. It's quite strong. So I found sniffing it first, really, really getting your nose in the glass and really sort of closing your eyes and concentrating on that's really great. And then I do put, even when I'm tasting whiskies as well, just a tiny drop of water just to bring the alcohol content down a tad. And then you can taste it.
And what's your preferred tonic? How would you make what's the ideal, like an LGG G&T? What's your recipe?
Well, we're using a Mediterranean style tonic at the moment for our pouring gin gin and tonic, but we've also made a couple of cocktails as well. So a martini with our gin, with a touch of Cointreau and a touch of Chartreuse, yellow Chartreuse.
And my goodness.
Yeah, I tell you, you've got to swing by and taste this one. A touch of yellow Chartreuse and dry vermouth. And it makes the most amazing martini. And we're also doing a champagne cocktail, so similar to a French 75, with the gin. And that's mind-blowingly good. In fact, it's too good.
And where is this on sale? Is it just at Gavroche, or are we going to see it on the Isles of Waitrose before too long?
Well, not at Waitrose as yet, but obviously we're using it as our pouring gin at Le Gavroche at the moment. You can actually buy a bottle from Le Gavroche and also on our e-shop, which is through the Le Gavroche website and the Nelson's Distillery website too. So it's and it's in a really cool, beautiful bottle, I must say.
Okay, well, it sounds good. Michelle, it's wonderful to catch up with you, and have a great autumn. We look forward to seeing lunch service up and running by Christmas. But it's wonderful to catch up with you. Thanks for joining me on Biting Talk.
Cheers. Always a pleasure to talk.
We are nearing the end of the last of the current season of Biting Talk. But of course, there's only one thing that happens before we close. We do it every time. We do it every week, week in, week out. We'll be doing it in perpetuity into the future when we come back again, as we will, stronger than ever. It's time to alight on the magic carpet of mixology with a man known as Farhad Haydari. Known as that because that is, of course, his name. Farhad, welcome to Biting Talk. You're doing something abracadabra-ish. You're mixing spells. I don't know. You send me a note. I can't even say it. What is this cocktail?
It's a Scrabble. Knock it out of the park. Point score. It's called Alabazam.
Alabazam, of course. Okay. Yes. This is actually something that came out of the New York Prohibition time, if I'm not wrong.
You're absolutely correct. It's sort of a delicious, fruity, punch-like drink. And it was originally published in 1891, Mr. Sitwell. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Come on.
We're going to take 2 ounces, that's 60 milliliters of cognac. We're going with our friends Remy Martin, our dear friends there. We're going to take 1 ounce or 30 milliliters of Grand Marnier, 1/2 ounce or 15 milliliters of fresh lemon juice, and 1/2 ounce or 15 milliliters of simple syrup, 2 dashes of orange bitters, and 1 ounce or 30 milliliters of club soda, and we're going to get a lemon wheel to garnish. Now, here's what we're going to do. We're going to combine all the ingredients except for the club soda in a cocktail shaker filled with our wonderful ice that's derived from, let's say, filtered water, and we're going to shake that vigorously, exaggeratedly so, let's say, aggressively, as this is the last episode in this series. And we're going to shake it for 15 to 20 to 30. You know what? Shake it until you can't hold that shaker anymore, until frosted on the outside, usually, straight into a Collins or a highball glass filled with more fresh ice. Top it with club soda and stir briefly, just a gentle one stir. Garnish it with that lemon wheel and
boom!
That's
for those of you, who don't want all the shenanigans, you can just pour Remy Martin into a glass and sip it. Very nice, actually. The XO, particularly good on its own.
Interesting. You could there's some variations to this drink. You could use Cointreau or Triple Sec in place of the Grand Marnier. Or instead of building the cocktail in the glass, you could shake it first with the first five ingredients I mentioned with ice and then strain over crushed ice. So, you know.
There you go. If you want full details of that, it'll, of course, be on Farhad Haydari's Instagram account, which is
at Mr. Farhad Haydari.
There you go. You heard it straight from the horse's mouth. Thanks, Farhad. There's been a lot of booze on this week's show. If the spirit's too much for you, head to williamshousewines.com, where there's a Chardonnay there by Olivier Coste that I reckon has your name on it. But that's it for this week's show and this season's collection of Biting Talks with Two Chicks. You can catch up with all of my chats with an extraordinary array of food and drink talent by searching for Biting Talk wherever you get your podcasts. My thanks to all my guests who have graced the Biting Talk table over the past few months. And if you enjoy the show, I promise you we'll be back in the autumn. So thank you for listening. And thank you to Two Chicks for their support. How about a Le Gavroche Gin Sour? With some of that egg white all fluffed up and ready to sip. My thanks also to producers Front Ear for their delicate touch week in, week out. I'm William Sitwell. Goodbye.